All right. Hello, everyone. Welcome back to the Action Filmmaking Podcast, a podcast dedicated to breaking down action films of all types. My name is Darren Tun, and with me is my lovely co-host, Skylar Tun. Today, we have a very special guest, the Sam Hargrave. He has an extensive filmography, including stunt coordination with the Marvel Cinematic Universe, and he just made his directorial debut with his new movie, Extraction, out now on Netflix. Sam, it's a pleasure to have you.
Thank you very much for allowing me to be here. You guys are awesome. It's an honor.
So, Sam, you have quite a massive filmography. IMDb said that you coordinated stunts in at least 80 films. So you got to have a huge martial arts repertoire. How did you get started in the world of martial arts?
My entry into the world of martial arts began quite some time ago in a small town in North Carolina where I grew up. I was born and raised there. And then it was actually my sister, I guess, who I could thank for this is at the time, my older sister and younger brother and I were, homeschooled, and we were watching a lot of these Xena Warrior Princess and Hercules Legendary Journeys was on TV, and we loved them. And I remember my sister, you know, wanting to be like Xena, and, you know, me and my brother and I like Hercules and Aeolus. And so my mom tells my sister, you know, she's a teenager, and she's like, you need to take self-defense classes. You need to be able to defend yourself. And, you know, my sister, you know, nods, rolls her eyes, whatever. So they enroll my sister. They buy this, you know, 10 lesson package, a Christmas special at the local Taekwondo studio. And then you're like, all right, it's time to go. And my sister says, I'm not wearing those pajamas. That's ridiculous. And so my parents are like, we have these 10 free lessons. Somebody is going to, we're not wasting this money. Somebody is going to take these classes. And I was like, I'll do it, you know. So at 14 years old, I started martial arts at a Taekwondo studio, and from lesson number one, I was hooked. You know, just seeing the discipline, hearing the crisp, you know, uniform snap as punches and kicks were thrown, and the ki eyes. I was like, oh man, this is a world I know nothing about, but I'm extremely intrigued. And that was my start in the martial arts.
That's really cool. I mean, the reason why Darren has me on this show at all is because I'm a martial arts guy too. I've been in Taekwondo for about, I think, almost 9 years now. And I understand completely how you feel. It's a whole different environment, and it is great.
Yeah, I loved it. You know, it gave me a chance to, it was a challenging experience for, you know, a young kid who's, it was into sports, playing baseball, basketball, and all kinds of things. But martial arts gave me a whole different kind of focus and a way to, learn about my body and the discipline and pushing myself. You know, or if you make a mistake, it's like 50 push-ups. And like, I didn't know I could do 10 push-ups, you know. So it was one of those things that was really a journey of self-discovery through physical movement and discipline. So it was really cool for me. And that kind of opened the door to Hong Kong cinema. You know, you're watching these people do all these moves, and they're like, hey, have you seen the latest Jackie Chan movie? You're like, who's Jackie Chan? And so then you see a Jackie Chan movie, and you're like, oh my God, this is a whole new level. And so then your training takes a whole new focus, and you're like, oh, I want to do these kind of moves. And so it was all connected. The movie world and the martial arts world for me were very interconnected from day one.
That's awesome. So as you've just mentioned, you're a big fan of Jackie Chan. What are some of your favorite Jackie Chan stunts, or one particular stunt that you remember being your favorite, and why?
Oh man, there's too many to number, but I think I was most impressed by watching Project A, like the clock tower stunt, and it kind of infused a lot of my. It's the crazy thing about, not only is it a crazy stunt, right? Like the guy falls, you know, hangs on a clock tower, falls probably about 40 to 50 feet through two awnings, lands on his head, delivers his line, and, you know, walks off frame. They don't cut once he falls. Like they double cut the fall. But if you watch it again, he did the stunt twice. Like so they're not double cutting the same fall with multiple cameras. He did it twice, and they showed both times, but then, you know, they cut back to the one and show it all again, boom, 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 wham, hits the ground. The camera zooms in and he gets up and he's like, you know, in pain, obviously. And he's just, he gasps his line and then just runs off, you know, out of frame, probably right to the hospital. But it was that kind of commitment to the every part of it. That was stunts. That's directing. That's, you know, acting. That's all of it. That's filmmaking. That was super inspiring to me. So I could go on. I mean, you get me started on Chan and his stunts and his career, I would talk for hours. But I would, if I narrow it down, that's the first stunt that came to mind as being making a huge impression on me as a kid.
Yeah, that's a legendary stunt. I remember it was inspired by Buster Keaton, if I'm not mistaken.
You're correct.
Yeah. So jumping, segueing from Jackie Chan, you have a pretty extensive stunt career. Do you recall one of probably the most difficult stunts that you had to perform or that you were asked to perform?
I've been very fortunate to have a pretty extensive and distinguished stunt career. And there's many stunts that I'm proud of, many that I've performed that I look back on fondly. But I think there's one particular stunt that I did, and it's a great segue from Jackie Chan because I was inspired by him and all of his guys. It was the stunt in Captain America Civil War in the opening when, Captain is running through these hallways and Crossbones is firing these explosive rounds, and one big explosion knocks Captain America, you know, through this glass over the balcony, and he hits one awning and falls to the truck and then falls to the ground. And the reason why that one is kind of just particularly challenging but rewarding is, you know, in the script it was just an explosion knocks Captain America out of a window and he falls to the ground and he gets up and runs off. And I was like, how can we take that and make it a little more exciting, a little more of an homage to the, you know, the stunts and the people I love, Jackie Chan style stuff? And so, you know, I pitched it. The Russo brothers loved it. And then I worked with the, you know, production designer and the art department to design the balcony at just the right angle to build in, you know, the high dense foam so that you could do it repeatedly and then, you know, measure the distance and do the rehearsals. Oh, the whole thing was very, you know, specifically and detailed construction based around the stunt I wanted to do. And then I, you know, the crazy thing was I not only coordinated, but then I got to do it. I did the second half. The first half was done by Jackson Spidell, another one of the Captain America stunt doubles, amazing performer, just an ace on a wire. And he just truthfully did the first part better. And I was like, you know what? It's not about the ego. It's about what's best for that character in the movie, and you do it better. So you're going to do that one. And so he did the first part of the explosion, pulled on a wire, hits the balcony and does a cool backflip. And then we cut, and then I took over where gravity could help me, and I just started on this boom arm. They call it like a Manitou or like a scissor lift, or not a scissor lift, a condor, they call it. So hold on to the bucket of the condor. I'm up, you know, probably 30, 40 feet off the ground, but 8 feet from the balcony or from the awning. And then on 3, 2, 1, go, I let go and fall backwards, hit the awning. Then I fall another 10, 12 feet to the hood of the truck or the top of the truck. I smack that face first and do a little Hong Kong spin down another 8 feet to the ground. And so, you know, that was a super satisfying stunt because it was mine from design to execution. And then I was very fortunate to get awarded 2 Taurus World Stunt Awards for it, for high work and hardest hit. So all in all, it was a very satisfying and yet extremely challenging stunt to execute and to, you know, survive.
That's amazing. Wow. So having done all these stunts, we're gonna jump a little bit more into you being in the director's chair now, experience as like a director and cinematographer, and more into the Extraction movie. I love watching you and Shelby have cameos in this movie, by the way.
thank you very much. We had fun.
Just a quick question before this part of the session. How are you doing during the coronavirus, and how do you feel like it's affected the release of your movie?
Personally, I'm doing well. You know, I'm very fortunate to live where I live and have kind of the setup that I have. I've got some space. You know, I've got things to do. Right.
Right.
I'm also fortunate to have kind of, you know, been brought up in a very self-disciplined household, so that, you know, I'm not every day is very structured, because I structure it myself. I'm like, all right, I'm getting up at, you know, 6 a.m. and I'm going to write for 3 hours with my writing partner. We're adapting a novel into a screenplay. So I'm writing and keep myself busy doing that, but I'm also training. So I'm working out, reading scripts, taking care of the chickens we got here, and doing lots of different projects around the property that I've wanted to do for a long time, but just haven't been here. So I'm just spending time with my girlfriend and, you know, the dog, and just really a lot of great quality time doing some very things that, you know, when you step back and think about your life, you're like, the things that are important, the things you'll remember, the moments that mean something, you know, a lot of those are made up of these times, you know. So it's really been a kind of a wake up call to me about what's important and how I spend my time. So I personally am doing well. Now, related to the release of the film, I think, you know, none of us could have foreseen anything like this coming down the pipe.
Right. Right.
But if this had been a traditional theatrical release, then it would have been very unfortunate, you know? So in that way, just kind of serendipitously, like, it wasn't on purpose. We went with Netflix for different reasons, because we believe in the platform, and, you know, we feel like it's kind of the future of films and how people are consuming media. And it was a right fit, because for us, this film on Netflix felt right for the reasons, you know, some of the ones I've already said, but then also medium budget or action movies of this size and scale aren't really being, you know, made at the studios or released theatrically, really, because, you know, the landscape is taken up mostly by big blockbuster tentpole superhero movies or lower budget comedies or family, you know, animated movies. So it's kind of a weird time for, you know, mid to upper budget action movies based on original content that aren't based on a comic book or a previous existing IP. So Netflix is a great home for movies like this. And our experience there was amazing. And we're very fortunate during this time to be able to release our film to, you know, a fan base who I believe is just very, in need of entertainment. You know, in times like this, especially, art and cinema are very important, because we need a break from this kind of, I want to say depressing, but it's all how you view it. But this crazy time and this anxiety laden environment that we find ourselves in. So I'm very pleased and very happy that we could, you know, release our movie to the world and people could be entertained and have an escape for even just a short amount of time.
That is very nice. I mean, I certainly think you have something there, that the movie industry may certainly take a shift into, streaming services like Netflix. And I think that what you said about, you know, seeing what matters the most in times like these, that's very profound. And, you know, I think you are right, you know.
Yeah, it's all, you know, everyone's situation is different. But for me, it's all about our lives are kind of all about attitude and perspective. And the only thing we really can control are those two things, how we view our life and our life circumstances. And then, you know, the attitude that we bring to it. And I try to be positive and try to look at it in a way that just kind of see the good in things and what positive can we take out of this. And so, you know, hopefully other people are having similar moments of thought and, consideration, because it's a really important time in our history as people.
Definitely. Definitely.
I love the mindset. Well, jumping in from that question, I know you've worked with the Russo brothers over the years. What are some of the biggest lessons that you've learned from them as mentors? And did their advice actually help you transition better from a stunt coordinator to the director's chair?
The Russo brothers have been extremely influential in my life and career, and their, you know, advice and mentorship allowed me to, make this transition. So I met them in 2013 on the set of Captain America, The Winter Soldier. And we got on well. I think that, you know, we had kindred spirits as far as the kind of movies we love, the way we like to see action and character-driven action. And so you know, working with them on that film, we became closer. Then they asked me to come on as a stunt coordinator for Civil War, and we got even closer. And then when I was directing second units for them on Infinity War and Endgame, the idea of this film came up, or the idea, Joe wrote it a long time ago, but the idea for me to direct it came up. And I think what I learned mostly from the Russo brothers during my time spent with them on their sets and just, you know, personally, is the importance of preparation, of having a script and a plan that is, you know, a very strong blueprint. And so you can shoot the script as best you can. But with that preparation comes the freedom to improvise if necessary. And they were very much like that on set, where they were extremely planned. We knew what the plan was, but if they found an idea or thought of something or saw something that would make the movie or the moment better, they would be open to change. And it was the adage of, you know, the best idea wins. No matter who it comes from, no matter when you have it, the best idea wins, and do whatever's best for the project. So I think those were probably the biggest lessons I took from my time with the Russo brothers.
I mean, obviously, from a director's perspective, I do think that it, being able to improvise when you're in a certain position can be a really good skill. Darren, you want to add on that?
Yeah, definitely. I think the improvisation part, it's like you don't really know what person has what idea that might add to the film. So I think that them giving you that freedom was really good.
Yeah, because, you know, there's a hierarchy, and if you just accept all ideas from anybody at any time, it becomes chaos. Like there is a method to it that must be kind of followed, right? But you need to remain open to ideas from places you might not have thought they would come from. And as long as it's kind of in like an orderly fashion, like if someone just says, hey, you know, takes you aside and says, hey, what about this? It doesn't mean listen to everyone's advice. It just means consider it, you know, honestly and openly, mm-hmm. without bias. It's like, but then do what's right for the project. So you might get advice from a producer or an idea from someone who's very close, like the writer, but then you as the director have to make the choice if that's right for the film.
Right.
And sometimes, you know, you know, from a very trusted or very respected source, a good idea might come down, but it might not be best for the movie as you see it. And you have to make that choice, and vice versa. Like some random source, like how did you think of this? But it might actually be a great idea, you know? So just try to be open to receive these ideas and try to filter through the information and find what's best for the project.
Right. Obviously you might have like a lot of people coming to you with ideas. What's your process of, like you say, filtering through these ideas?
Say no to everything first. No, I'm kidding. I set up, fortunately, I had a very, you know, great system in place with my starting out as my assistant, Shelby Malone, but then she quickly became like an associate producer on the movie because she was so valuable. But we got to where the biggest thing that was surprising about directing for me was the sheer volume of questions I would have to field in a day. So we devised a way for people, kind of a system. People would go through her first, and she'd filter the questions, and I could, if I had, you know, I'd say, hey, just ask Shelby if I, you know, wasn't prepared or whatever. But it was like a buddy system where, you know, she helped field things, and it would filter through her so that I could focus on the task at hand, which is directing a movie. And then, you know, the important questions, she would kind of prioritize, and she'd be like, hey, this, we gotta do this. And she understood the movie as well as I did, you know, inside and out, what we needed to do. So it was a very good partnership as far as working through that and answering the most pertinent questions in a timely manner.
Yeah, that sounds very helpful. I want to transition from that into more of the action scenes now. I know that there are some pretty extensive action scenes in this movie. How has your career as a stunt coordinator actually helped you maneuver the camera more efficiently, as you were the cameraman also in a lot of these scenes?
I was. I mean, my career has been, you know, heavily revolving around stunts, because that was my day job, if you will. I always wanted to direct. I always knew I would. it was just a matter of, you know, getting there and the when and the how. So I think I started, even in stunts, I started as a filmmaker. And so I had an idea based on my exposure to Hong Kong cinema and how much I loved watching the way they shot and edited action. So I had an idea, you know, inspired by that, of how I like to see action. And I shot a lot of short films, a lot of fight scenes back in North Carolina. So I came to LA with a, you know, kind of a general knowledge of maybe more than your average stuntman would have. So that was helpful in the stunt business because, you know, understanding lenses and, you know, film speed and frame rates and all these things where you could look at a thing and go, you know what, they're on 100mm here. Gonna be pretty tight. Maybe I don't have to do as crazy of a fall because they're gonna, it's more about, you know, wiping through frame.
Right.
Or if like, oh, they're on a 24 or a 35 now and they're seeing the world, I gotta sell out. So it helped me in my stunt career. But then, you know, the stunt side of things, the performing side of things helped me to understand what, you know, what I want to see and how to communicate that to other stunt performers as a stunt coordinator, but then also as, you know, communicate to actors doing action and how I want to see, or other stunt people and how I want to see action performed. And then truthfully, a lot of the desire to, you know, get to coordinate and second and direct and see my own action was you would have these somewhat disappointing experiences. And a lot of that disappointment is all based on expectations, right? So that's where it gets very interesting. It can become very philosophical. You know, you only be disappointed if something doesn't meet your expectations. So how do you avoid that? Just don't have expectations, you know, set on that certain thing. You can have standards, but expectations set of, oh, it has to be this way. That's all going to go out the window because there's so much compromise in filmmaking. But I digress. So in my career, you know, you'd feel like, oh, I see this a certain way. This is how I expected to go. And you do these crazy fights and this is how it was designed. And then you'd see the final product and you go, what the heck is that? Like, what are these quick cuts and tight angles? And I can't see any of the beautiful things that were the stunt team choreographed.
Right.
And it was frustrating. And so like it was shaky, like, man, cam. Yeah, shaky cam, or just, you know, you'd put this thing in there. Like, well, this is really important for the story at the time. And, you know, you had this feeling that you understood, you know, how the action scene ought to be cut. Now, as a director, you know, you now see the truth of it is that the action's important, but if it doesn't tell story, if it's just a cool thing, sometimes that has to be cut out for time, for efficiency, because you're seeing the big picture as a storyteller. But I do believe that over the years, Chet Stahelski, David Leitch, and other great filmmakers, action filmmakers, have shown that you can have both. You can have a compelling story with characters that you care about, and you can still see, understand, and appreciate beautiful action. And that's what I hoped to do with Extraction and tried to do, which, and then, you know, coming back to your question, as a stunt coordinator, knowing kind of where to put the camera. So that background led me to say, okay, this is how I believe, like, I can still tell my story as a director, but for action fans and to satisfy that, you know, stunt man inside of me, I think that the camera's here. People are really going to love that. I love it. It's more exciting. And so the two come together when shooting these action sequences where the director and stunt coordinator become one and you put the camera in the best place to tell the story as well as capture the action.
Right. So really quickly, there was this pretty big car chase sequence in the movie. And I think a lot of us saw the behind the scenes where you were strapped up to this big camera rig. I'm just wondering, just curious, like, what did that camera rig actually consist of where you're strapped onto that that vehicle?
Yeah.
And was it like custom built? Yeah.
Yeah, it was. I mean, the idea, once we decided to shoot the entire chase, both foot chase, car chase, hand to hand, all these things we wanted to do, this entire sequence handheld, then we set about devising the best way to do that. And so it's a little more self-explanatory when it's fighting and running, it's handheld and you hold the camera and you run and walk and move it to follow the action. When it was time to do the car chase, how do you get a handheld feel while being able to keep up with vehicles? Like, I can't run that fast. So how do you execute this? So we found these, you know, based on these camera vehicles that my brother, Daniel Hargrave, had in Georgia, these kind of UTVs, these utility terrain vehicles, or these ATVs, all-terrain vehicles, that can go in lots of places through dirt, mud, rocks, but also on the street. We kind of modeled this camera car after that and put, you know, both front and side mounts or plates where I could stand and be hooked in. We made a nest, if you will, like a camera nest where I could move around comfortably, but be hooked in safely. And then because we knew we were going to be leading the cars through certain things, we're going to be tracking with them and chasing them. So we just set up the car, the camera car, in all those different positions. But it kind of, you know, I became the arm of a camera car. I would go. And the thing that that I liked about that, not only was it staying true to the style that we wanted to express for that sequence, it allowed me as the director, but also operating and stunt person, to react to situations as they unfolded. So I didn't have to communicate through, you know, to the DP, then to the camera operator and say, hey, you know, do this moment. If I felt something happening, like if I saw, you know, in a fight scene, Chris take a stumble back here and he didn't hit his mark, I could know, okay, they're going to keep going. So I would shift my weight and try to keep going and not lose the sequence, you know? So sometimes if the marks aren't hit, people give up on it. They go, cut, cut, cut. You know, we didn't hit it, let's start again. Whereas I felt like I could save a lot of moments and sequences by understanding how the action was going to happen and reacting based on my many years of being, you know, in front of the camera and seeing stunts and designing them. So that was part of my reasoning, was just put myself there to just hopefully make the process smoother and capture stuff exactly how I wanted to without having to, you know, explain it or rely on someone else to capture it. And there was the danger element. I didn't feel comfortable putting, you know, camera operators who there's, you know, that's what they do. There's some of these guys that we got, especially the ones we got, some of the best in the world. And they could totally do the stuff I did with enough rehearsal. We just, one, didn't have the time. And two, some of those things were really dangerous. I mean, there were times when, you know, there were spinning, speeding cars going by my feet, like it was passing 6 inches in front of my legs at 30 miles an hour. And like, you know, if something went wrong, for whatever reason, I felt better about it being me in that spot than other people.
Gotcha. Okay.
Sounds really dangerous.
That rig also allowed you to unclip, right? And also correct. Go on. Yeah.
Yeah. So it allowed me to get on and off the rig so that I could blend this high speed camera car feel with a little more intricate, intimate moves where I would go from, you know, chasing the car to inside the car. And so it freed up a lot of the blends that I wanted to do and allowed that style to really shine through.
Yeah, that's definitely awesome. There's so many tricks too when it comes down to filming like the fight scenes. I remember when I was watching one of the first fight scenes in the movie, there's so many like props, like wooden knives, like you were saying, like soft floors, dummies, rubber props. Like what's the process of actually designing these very specific items for these scenes?
You know, as an action designer, the you're trying to come up with cool ways to tell the story, but safely execute the stunts. So we tried to, in that environment, we were like, hey, how do you take on this many attackers who have weapons and you don't? Like, you have to use your environment, you know, kick a table into another guy, use a cup, like a mug to hit the guy in the face a little harder, save your fist so you don't break your hand, or, you know, a rake, for crying out loud. So we tried to design all, you know, exciting actions that we would enjoy seeing as action fans. And then the trick, the challenge, the part of the fun is how do you then utilize those things safely? So, you know, for example, you know, there were how many of those? One, two, like four different versions of that rake. There was the hero rake. So when you get close-ups, you know, you want to see the hero rake hole. It's metal, it's wood, it feels dangerous. And then there's also the hero broken one. So when you get a close-up of the broken rake, there's two. Then you have like a full-length rubber rake so that when you swing it, it's in motion. You can't tell that it's not real, but it's if you miss time or you're off a little bit with your aim and you hit the stunt guy, you know, he doesn't take a rake to the face and get seriously injured. So then you've got one that's, the handle of the rake with no top on it, because when you swing it and it breaks, we had also break ones that would break that were made of balsa wood. but sometimes they didn't break the way you wanted them to. So we had just a handle so you could do that digitally. So it's all these things that you use. And part of the importance of understanding the process and everybody's job is it allows you to have more tools and more ability to tell stories in creative ways. Because if you didn't know that, if you just said, all right, well, I want to kill it out of the rake. Well, we got to use a real rake. Then it can become very difficult and very dangerous. So all those little movie tricks is really important, I think, to designing fun action, is just to understand what you're trying to do and all the different ways to best and most safely execute your vision.
Now, I do want to stick on this point about the props. Because right now we're going to break into the part of our session where we go into the fight scenes a little deeper and try to, I don't want to say nitpick, but we're going to pick on the details a little more.
Do it. I love this stuff. Come on.
All right. So for the first fight scene and for the fight against the Kid Army, as we termed, you know, you see people, well, Tyler Rake, he kicks a table into somebody's head. In the Kid Army fight scene, he knocks a motorcycle over and that traps a kid. What's your process when you organize a fight scene that relies a lot on the use of the environment?
My process is generally similar. It's always finding, first and foremost, what story are you trying to tell with this action? And then once you find your story, you're like, all right, what are the character-driven ways in which the, you know, your lead or whoever's in that fight is going to execute this action? And then try to mix it. Okay, now we have the story, we have how we're going to do that. Now let's think of cool ways, not just because they're cool, but ways that make sense to the character and the story, but are inventive or cool, that can do that, can tell the story. So, you know, we thought, for example, in the Kid Army fight, the Goonies from Hell part, you know, he doesn't want to, you know, kill these kids. He's got a code as kind of morally gray as Tyler Rake can be at times. He has a code where you see in the first fight where he doesn't kill the kid that, you know, tries to shoot him. He's like, you know, I draw the line here. And so he has some moral code. So knowing that about him, he can't just kill the kids. So how do you then fight these kids that have guns and machetes? And how do you do, like, that's a dangerous thing. And these kids are out to get you. So how do you do this? So we thought, let's, you know, smoke, use your tools, use your environment. The smoke grenade is smart because it's harder to see. He can get closer without risking getting shot. And then using his environment, like in taking them out of the fight without killing them. So the first kid whose arm he slams in the door, like that, you know, that kid's kind of taken out of that fight. He's stuck to the side of the van, not killed. Very painful to have your, you know, hand or arm slammed in a door, but he's not dead. And then, you know, the next guy,
incapacitated,
right. Taken out of the fight. Cause that's story driven. That's not just like, oh, let's just smash a kid's arm, cause that'll be cool. It's like, he has to take these kids out because you don't want to deal with five, you know, these five kids all at once. How do I whittle down the numbers to my advantage? So take one out with that. And then, you know, you throw the kid, knock the motorbike onto his leg. Now he's trapped and incapacitated. And then, you know, slam one kid into the side of a car and now he's sleeping, hopefully, and he's incapacitated. And then, you know, so then slowly he works his way through these kids and in ways that we're hoping were inventive and, you know, bone crunching, but not deadly, so that you tell the story that's true to his character, that he's trying to incapacitate these kids and take them off the board without killing them.
Right. I think that's definitely adds another layer to the story and Tyler Rake's character. I was going to ask, do you think, in your general opinion, of course, that when we choose fighting styles for certain characters, is it indicative of their personal traits or, you know, their personality? Because when I look closer at the kid fight scene, you know, somebody could just, you know, toss these kids aside. I mean, the other kinds of characters, maybe more villainous characters, could actually, you know, hurt them. But I noticed that Tyler Rake was slapping them, and it was kind of funny to see. Do you think that that's indicative of his personality in a way, other than his place on the moral scale being kind of gray?
Definitely. I mean, because all action has to either move the story forward and or reveal something about character. So, you know, his personality, his character is revealed through his actions. Seeing him open hand slap a kid rather than close fist punch him in the face, that tells a story. That's saying that, you know, I understand my strength. I understand that, like, that one way is going to hurt more than the other, but I still got to take the kid out. Even one way is even going, you know, a psychological level deeper, is one way is more insulting and more dismissive. You know, like the open hand slap is like, just right. Stop wasting my time, which, you know, then comes. But that also, see, the time we're talking layers, we're setting things up that get paid off later. So, you know, imagine that insulting move from Tyler's perspective, it means one thing, but now take it to Farhad, the kid who got slapped in the face and beaten down in that way. Then that now motivates him for his actions that come later in the movie. So, you know, the action is informing the story and telling you about character at the same time. So we definitely, when I'm designing action, it's got to be based on the personality of your character and, you know, where they come from, where they're going. It's storytelling through action.
I really like that. I think that's really the beauty of, like, the choreography of a fight scene. Like, you can tell a story in a fight, and I think that's great. But let's focus on the story part. I want to move a little bit deeper into a real breakdown of the third fight scene, the knife fight scene. So I noticed that Tyler Rake, for this scene, he was using a karambit, and, you know, you have the very savage and messy slashes from both ends. But I did notice that nearing the end of the fight, Tyler Rake disarms the other guy with the knife in a way that I noted as kind of unorthodox. Did you consult any Special Air Service regiment military officials for these kinds of techniques, or was that just a heat of the moment kind of survivalist move?
For the specific combat moves, I mean, we didn't consult specialists, in that field. When I was choreographing fights, I would do research on characters and talk with people and just, you know, look, watch videos, read books, find what the style's kind of background is. And now, you know, the sandbox you can play in. And truthfully, you know, I would come in with overarching comments, but I, you know, as the director, I didn't have time to choreograph all these moves myself. So I hired an awesome team. Daniel Stevens was who is my long-time friend, known him since the Wolverine days back in 2007. Oh, he was my stunt coordinator. And then, you know, he hired Michael Lair, who was our fight choreographer. I had Thayer Harris there, who's my good friend and was second unit director, and, you know, Dan Carter and Travis Gomez and, you know, a lot of great martial stunt minds, and Bobby Holland Hanton, you know, would pitch in. So we had a lot of people coming up with these moves, and our idea with Rake, and, you know, interesting, you know, comments that you make there, is the energy that he brings to his style is it's forward moving. Like, he doesn't, the first time you see him back up, and the only reason he backs up in that moment when, you know, he's on the ground and Saju swings at him is like, right. You know, he's taken by surprise and he's a little out of it. But the rest of the time, pretty much, he's moving forward. And so the idea was that he's aggressive. And yes, there's a lot more intricate choreography with a karambit that you can do. But for us, like, his character is not about flash, flare, or details. It's about forward moving,
right.
Like blunt force, aggressive trauma, and try to end the conflict as soon as possible. So those, you know, those moves, they're not going – it's like watching, you know, Dan Henderson in the UFC. Like, he's not like stick and move. He's not Floyd Mayweather. He's not jabbing and dancing around. And by the 12th round, I'm going to wear you out. It's like, if I swing my right hand, and if I connect, you're done. Like, the fight's over and I go home. So the idea for him was, like, just each thing is to try to take him out. So when he gets close, he is improvising as he goes. Like, that disarm, you know, it was with the kind of blunt side of the knife there, or the hand of the base of the knife. And that was kind of a desperation move. He's been trying to stab him. Now he gets himself in a spot where he's trapped. And then he goes, you know, he tries to take the guy's head off. But now that he's done that, he's like, let me get rid of this weapon. Raise my advantage now. I've got my weapon. He doesn't. But then it also, you know, we see the personality kind of come out of, you know, he doesn't just immediately go for the jugular. He's like trying to get some space to breathe. Like, once he you know, disarms a knife, slashes him, you know, like kicks him and punches him and kicks him again. He's not immediately for this guy, like going, he's so pushed on his heels that he's just using all of his weapons. He's not like so, and that was something else we tried to focus on is like, okay, if you have a knife in general, a lot of times people focus on just the knife and all the moves with the knife. Like you've got your hands, your feet, your knee, you got other weapons. And so we wanted to incorporate him using those, which we thought was cool. Was after he slashes him, he's like, dude, I'm off balance for that, but I'm on balance for a kick or a left hand. I'm going to use whatever is the closest, most efficient weapon in that moment to like push my enemy back. And so, you know, a lot of the choreography specifics come out of character and, you know, a stunt team just coming up trying to find the best idea for that character at that moment in his story arc.
Right. Right. I certainly like that his fighting style is more efficient because that does add, again, another layer of character to Tyler Rake. And well, like you said, most people would be just focusing on the knife. Like you want to do this kind of slash, this kind of stab, blah, blah, blah. The karambit is supposed to be known as, you know, a kind of blade for powerful strokes and these ripping motions. But I really like how you decided to opt for a more balanced approach into choreography. That's how I would put it.
Great. Well, I appreciate that. I mean, the credit there, you know, I oversaw it and I, you know, said yes or no to certain things, but the design of that was the stunt team and they deserve the credit for that. They did a great job with the action in this movie.
That's awesome. Yeah. I had another question for you, Sam, from more of the directorial standpoint. If you were to give a director, let's just say, a new director, three pointers on actually selling a fight scene, what would those pointers be?
Good question. I think first, number one would be to emulate the masters who have come before you in your practice, because to find your own voice, you have to, you know, practice something. So instead of putting the pressure on yourself to be creative and do new things, do old things well, you know, like just take a Jackie Chan fight scene and recreate it shot for shot and see why it works. Why does it, you know, why do you like it? Why do you not like it? You might think, oh, I don't like the style. But by doing that, you will learn good habits. You know, you will learn how masters do stuff. And then you can kind of start to develop your own style. So I'd say like, they'll learn from the best and emulate those who've come before you. And then second, focus on, don't forget about story and character. You know, like, because so many times it becomes about the moves and like my choreography is, it's cool, it's unique, I got to use my hand in this way. Don't forget that, yes, you know, the moves are cool, but the importance is the story that you're telling through the moves. And the other, it would be to be flexible. Number three, be flexible with your performers, with your talent, because sometimes in an action scene, something that you've got in your head that you think is the coolest thing, or you really want to see this thing done a certain way. And then the actor who's performing it, he shows up and he's left-handed, you know, and all the stuff you've done is for a right-handed actor. And you're like, oh gosh, what do I do? You've got to be able to adapt and do what the actor can do comfortably. Because if they can't perform it well, it's not going to translate. You know, you may have somebody, you've got this character in your mind, like, oh, this guy's an amazing kicker. He does all this crazy stuff, but your guy, you know, he can't kick above his knees. And so you're like, oof, I may have to change this. His style may have to be a little different. Be open to that, because the most important thing is who your performers are and making them look great, because then that people will remember great performances. They're not going to remember, you know, usually they're not going to remember like the one or two moves that you thought were amazing, usually.
Right. Well, Sam, thank you so much. Before you go, we actually have one last question for you. Having been, you know, doing all these films and having worked on these films as stunt coordinator and director, these three characters, Tyler Rake from Extraction, Lorraine Brockton from Atomic Blonde, Christian Wolf from The Accountant, we thought, what was your perspective on who would win in that fight between those three characters?
Ooh, my gosh. That is, I tell you what, just for fans of action cinema out there, how badass would that be to have those three people, you know, engaged in an action scene together? Whether they're whether they're working together or against one another, I mean, that would be just phenomenal. Oh God, this is so hard because, you know, Christian Wolff is a guy who, you know, it's a mathematical equation for him, and he like sees all the angles, and it's like, it would be hard to outplan that guy. But, you know, there's very few people that have kind of like the raw aggression and strength and fortitude that, you know, Tyler Rake has. But then the never say die attitude and craftiness of Lorraine Broughton, you can't bet against her. But because Extraction just came out, and because, you know, I mean, all of it, Ben, Charlize, Chris, they're all friends of mine, so I can't say anything, but they're all great. But since we're promoting Extraction, let's say Tyler Rake. Let's say Tyler Rake's gonna, he'd take home the cake.
Definitely. Okay.
That's fair.
All right, man. Thank you so much for being on the podcast and taking the time out to answer our questions. We really appreciate it.
Darren, Tyler, thank you very much. It was a pleasure. You guys stay safe and be well.
All right. Thank you so much.
Thank you.
Thanks, guys.